Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the debut show of Revolution Radio. This is Dr. Kate, your host, and we're a little bare bones this evening, just starting out. I want to say a couple of things to inaugurate the show and then introduce our two fabulous guests, and as soon as our guests are fully on, I will unmute them, so just so they know what's going on here. But John F. Kennedy said, and I believe this is the right quote, those who make peaceful revolution impossible make violent revolution inevitable. And I want to start out by saying we patriots are doing everything we possibly can to make non-violent revolution possible, peaceful revolution possible. And the examples of work that I'd like to highlight on this radio show for how long it ever exists is really about the revolution that we can create using the construct of the laws that we have to bring our country back. So those of you who came on last night and didn't get the show, I'd like to mention a couple of words about that if you don't mind. And I'll just read this out and let you take that for what it is. I promise I won't take 4 or 5 hours. I really do. I'll take about 1 minute. But I really value my work product as long as you know. The purpose, the time spent to develop the articles I post, both on my own blog and on Texas Darling before I got here, and the exchange of information is really important to me. I was fortunate enough to find JBJD's work on the internet and felt from her the same devotion and integrity of the work product in what she was producing on the blogs. And I want to note that if you've ever been to her blog, you will take a look at any comments and questions that are raised. JBJD actually takes the time to answer those questions. And as a result, it's a very educational blog. So I really very much wanted her on Constitutional Radio last night, which I co-host. But the opportunity, I just wanted to say there's some past things. Our first opportunity to have JBJD was on September 14th, and it just so happened at that time that J.B. Williams apparently had taken the work of JBJD, and through a long and complicated and kind of ridiculous process, J.B. Williams ended up on Constitutional Radio, rather than JBJD. My co-host was, I was not there, of course, I was out of town. My co-host was not gracious about it and proceeded to chastise JBJD. In any case, we can go through all of that, but I want to get right down to work this evening. And so last night was a snafu. I had achieved agreements to do this show and to give JBJD the avenue. There were some mix-ups and, frankly, you know, some kind of rough behavior. So I just figured it's time. Like I said, revolution begins at home. A revolution started last night. Let's get right down to work. So if that's okay with you, and I'm just alone myself on the chat, so I don't, you know, won't be doing a whole lot of stuff, but I'd first like to introduce D2I. Now, D2I is basically just like everyone else who I met. I met her in D.C. at the 9/12 march, which was great. But just like everyone else who watched the political shenanigans during the 2008 election cycle and observing something was wrong, and she was determined to do something about it. But since the issues were facing us were issues of first impression, they required creative problem solving. Oops, this is JBJD. My apologies. Excuse me, JBJD. And in fact, let me get you on the line here. And let me unmute you both. There you go. D2I?
Hello?
I'm sorry, I screwed up already. JBJD?
I'm here.
Are you there?
Can you hear me?
Thank you for joining us. Thank you for joining us this evening. I appreciate the opportunity for you to come back this evening and take your time. So let me start with D2I. Whoops, wrong sheet. D2I.
No, wait,
do you want to do that? Why don't you do that?
Can I just ask you something? I don't need to hear the show to be able to talk to you on the phone. But for some reason, that whole introduction I just listened to through the phone, I couldn't hear on the radio. Is that possible? Or am I doing
something? Yeah. Do you have your radio muted?
I'm all set. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Great. Very good. Thank you. Well, it's on the podcast, but the introduction really is about what happened last night, so forth, but my larger goals here is let's start a revolution with the information we have. Now, D2I, formerly a lifelong Democrat until May 31st, 2008, when the DNC Rules and Bylaws Committee gave Hillary's delegate to Obama. Since then, she has dedicated her time to revealing the truth about how the DNC elite stole the election from the rightful winner, Hillary Clinton. Now, D2I has been working with JBJD, who I'll introduce in a second, and my goal this evening is to have them both have a discussion about essentially the eureka moment that led JBJD to where she is right now. Now, JBJD, like I said, is like someone else who watched the political shenanigans and observed something was wrong and was determined to do something about it. In one of her posts on treason, she laid out very clearly, look, you know, if you don't do everything you can to find out how to get these people accountable, well, you know, you really need to do everything you can. So I remembered that. But the issues were facing us at that time, first impression, and it was hard to get your hands around the problem. So this required JBJD's creative problem solving, and that is her strength. Based on her own concerns and a response to concerns posted in the comments throughout the blogosphere, she began problem solving and posting her own solutions. She always figured if people were smart enough to rig the system, she was smart enough to find them out and to fix what they had done and figure them out. And that to me is like the definition of revolution. So please welcome D2I and JBJD. Welcome. Take it over, girls.
Hey, D2I.
Hi, JBJD. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good. So
happy that we finally got on the air.
I know. It's taken us a while, hasn't it?
It really
we're
has.
Here now.
Well, Dr. Kate, I would like to say thank you very much. And I would also like to say how honored I am to be in the company of two fabulous patriots and two individuals that have been driven and determined and committed to be able to not only try to figure out the puzzle and what occurred over the last 18 months, but has been absolutely respectful and appropriate in approaching all that has occurred. And Dr. Kate, when it comes to your blog site, Dr. Kate to you, and all of the constitutional work you have been doing and educating all of us, Neanderthals or unsophisticated law readers, whatever, has been such a gift. And I thank you so much because you have connected me back to what I guess is probably the greatest gift I've ever received, and that is to be born in the United States of America and to be a part of this country. So with that, Dr. Kate, I just can't thank you enough. JBJD, when it comes to the work you have done over the course of the last 18, 19 months, it's been quite phenomenal to watch you conduct and kind of piece together this puzzle. And where I'd like to start tonight, because Dr. Kate has agreed, or should I say she extended to you and I, the opportunity to talk about all of this over a three-hour period. So we will have the opportunity tonight to touch on some of the key points and for an hour and a half, and then we will come back next week and pick up where we left off and allow ourselves the opportunity to go into further development of what is occurring and so on and so forth. So given that, what I would like to propose is for our listeners, because many of these folks are new, as well as some of the old-timers that are like Maverick, who's crazy about Dr. Kate and others, as well as you and I. What I'd like to be able to do, if I could, is ask you to start from the beginning, where and how you began to identify peculiarities or question marks about some of the decisions that were being made by the Democratic National Committee's Electoral Committee. And I think that is a wonderful place to start because it provides the foundation that is necessary to be able to allow our listeners to understand how this began and how the road was paved, so to speak, to be able to ultimately commit the fraud that we've discussed, and of course we have brought various memorandum complaints to state attorney generals. So, JBJD, I would like to ask you to start from the beginning and ask you where or how or what were the red flags you saw? What were you seeing?
Okay.
Exactly.
The first thing I want to say is I am just like everybody else who was complacent and trusting and assumed there was a process and assumed the process would be carried out the way it was supposed to be carried out. I am no different from anybody else. I voted. I read up on some of the issues, but basically I was as awestruck with the process unfolding before me as everybody else, as most of our listeners, as most of the people who were blogging beginning in the 2008 general election cycle, just like everybody else. And the same kinds of inappropriate conduct I observed was the same conduct being observed by everybody else. The caucus fraud, the videos that started appearing on the internet, the limited news coverage of what we knew was going on. I, like so many other people, found myself looking to Fox News to get the news. So I don't want to dwell on my ignorance in the first few months of the primary cycle, because everybody else knows what that felt like and what that was like. But what happened was, what struck me, what first got me to think there's a big problem going on here, people were complaining to their state government that, for example, there's caucus fraud and my vote wasn't counted, and on and on and on with all the infractions we all know about. And the state government wasn't doing anything to help these people. And it suddenly hit me. Well, of course they can't do anything, because the state government isn't running for office. Candidates from a private club are running for office. Sorry.
I was just going to say, when you say private club, describe private club for me.
Well, the DNC is a corporation. Okay, it's the Democratic National Committee Services Corporation or something. So I think of them as a private club because they're not a government. They're not subject to say public records laws, which most of us already know because we've tried to obtain documents from them. So I began to look at this in a different way. Instead of saying, well, wait a minute, my right to vote is being infringed, or equal protection or due process, none of those constitutional rights was being impinged because this was a private club doing it. It wasn't the government doing it. Do you see? Is that distinction, am I making the distinction clear, or am I being confusing?
No, I think you're basically saying it's a the club is a entity under the IRS laws which governs the activities under whatever code the DNC is under. So therefore,
yes,
they are a private entity versus,
yes,
the federal government, the public, or the state government,
yes,
that is much more open and must apply their laws equitably.
Yes.
Therefore, FOIA requests and things of that nature are appropriate, whereas with a private entity, they have no responsibility to be able to respond.
Yes.
So I'm hearing private entity versus a federal or state government.
Correct.
Exactly.
So and may I just interject as well? So basically, everyone was trying to go after the state government, secretaries of state, you know, federal government to try to get this eligibility piece looked at, but we couldn't because it was a private club.
I'm so sorry. No. This was before that point. I'm talking about addressing the conduct.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I'll shut up.
No, okay. That's okay. But I just want to stress that for the first few months, I was like everybody else. observing, changing news stations, complaining. I started blogging. But it didn't really hit me that the reason that nothing can be done about what we clearly know is going on is that we're talking about the conduct of a private club. So that's the first thing that hit me, that oh, think of the DNC as a private club, and then things begin to make sense, okay? And then I, too, watched the May 31st Rules and Bylaws Committee meeting. And I'm telling you, I was in love with Harold Ickey. I was crying. It was the saddest thing. But I realized, but that's just what the charter of the DNC says, that there has to be a fair reflection of the voters' intent in the primary. And it's a private club, so if they want to ignore their constitution, they can do that. Our government officials can't, but they can. So it was like a death to me. I mean, the tears were because I realized they're doing whatever they want. Now what am I going to do about it? So now we are into June, and here's what happened. I'd like to talk about the vote-binding states I discovered. And the reason I want to bring that up, and the reason I want people to understand this concept of vote-binding states, is because recently, and D2I will fill this in, recently we learned that I might have stumbled upon the reason there was no floor vote at the Constitution. I might just have done that in the summer of 2008 when I discovered this thing was screaming my head off like what's the cartoon character, Chicken Little, the sky is falling, and nobody, it seemed nobody was hearing me. There were a few people in the blogosphere saying, oh my God, I think JBJD figured out what was going on. At any rate, let me explain. In the beginning of June, if you recall, Barack Obama posted on his website a document, we all know, called a COLB. And he said, explicitly he said, I know there have been questions about my eligibility. Well, here's proof that I'm a native citizen. Of course, right away, the word native jumped out at me because the Constitution says natural born, and because I had seen other documents, which he signed to get into primaries in various states, where he said, I am a natural born citizen. So why does he use natural born at one point and native born at this point? So things started jumping out at me. Every inconsistency I saw jumped out at me. And then I happened to be reading Heidi Lee's blog. And on her blog was a letter from a pledged Hillary Clinton delegate from Georgia saying, well, look at the kinds of letters that Obama's people are sending to us pledged delegates here in Georgia. They're embarrassing. They're threatening us if we don't change our vote. Da, 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 da. And this was in June, right after Hillary Clinton suspended her campaign. Now, remember, the primary had gone on for months, and she had amassed several hundred pledged delegates. So this letter from the Georgia pledged delegate said, we're being harassed to change our votes in June, this is, to vote, to commit to voting for Barack Obama before the convention. And I saw that letter, and it suddenly struck me. Hillary Clinton had suspended her campaign. I knew nothing about campaigns, politics, conventions, but it suddenly hit me. Her pledged delegates are all across the country, wherever they were elected, and because she, for whatever reason, was forced to suspend her campaign, she can't hold their hands now. She can't protect them. They're like sheep out there with the wolves of Obama descending upon them, threatening them, we'll announce your name at the next meeting if you don't fill out this information form with your name and your cell phone and da-da-da-da, embarrass you by calling out your name. I mean, this was kindergarten stuff. So at any rate, I read that letter on Heidi Lee's blog, and all these thoughts are going through my head, these poor delegates. Now, at the same time, I heard on the news a delegate, I think from Colorado, Dr. Kate, maybe you recall this, was complaining that she was being harassed because she was a Clinton delegate and they wanted her to switch to Obama before the convention. But in her state, the law said if you are a pledged delegate, you have to stay with that candidate to the convention. And I thought, you mean there are states that have laws that say if you're a pledged delegate, you are a pledged delegate? So then I thought to myself, I wonder if Obama's people are harassing people all over the country. So
I remember that, Debbie J.D.
Remember that? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back to Heidi Lee's blog, and this is like a detective story. I went back to Heidi Lee's blog because I wanted to see if – I have to make a correction. Heidi Lee had posted some letters that were sent to a delegate in a state. I don't remember the state. But I don't want to get bogged down in the details, but the point is that when I saw on TV another delegate was being harassed, I went back to Heidi Lee's blog to see if anybody had weighed in from other states to Heidi Lee's posting, and somebody from Georgia was saying, yeah, he's harassing me. I said, oh, wait a second. Then they must be doing this to every state. And guess what? I looked up the laws to find out if there are other states that say if you're a pledged delegate in the primary, you must vote for that candidate at the convention. And I found out there were 13 of those states, and one of them was Georgia. So the delegate in Georgia who posted on Heidi Lee's blog saying, I'm being harassed, I knew that that state is one of those states where you can't be harassed because it's the law, you change your vote till you get to the convention. And I thought, you know what? If you're harassing somebody who by law cannot change her vote, then you're enticing somebody to break the law. And that's criminal, and we should turn you in. I decided I'm going to turn in Obama's people to the Attorney General in every state that was harassing pledged delegates. So I gathered up examples, the woman on TV and the person who posted on Heidi Lee's blog, and I did searches for any evidence of harassment. And I found several examples, and I annotated them, and I looked up the laws, and I cited the law, and I looked up the Attorney General, and I decided what I would do was this. Now, this is, again, in the summer of 2008, because I wanted to hold the hands of the Hillary Clinton delegates, because I thought if she loses all her delegates before the convention to these predatory Obama people, it doesn't matter anyway. She's going to lose the nomination. So my goal was to contact the Attorney General and say, this is happening, put a stop to it. Copy the Secretary of State, copy the Democratic State Party chair, and anonymously make a copy, find all the Hillary Clinton pledged delegates in that state, send a little note to them with just this little message, we have your back. So they'd know, they'd see that somebody's writing to their Attorney General, somebody's looking out for them, because Hillary Clinton couldn't do it because for whatever reason, she suspended her campaign, and I figured somebody has to step in. I'm a normal person just like everybody else. I didn't know anything about this. It just suddenly hit me. Do you see? Seeing, reading the blogs, looking at the news, it just suddenly hit me. So let's stop there for a minute. Because there must be questions about this stuff.
Yeah. Are you there?
Yeah.
Yeah, very good. Well, so you would say that was your first eureka moment when you took a look at, basically, look, delegates are being harassed, but in 13 states, you say, the delegates are committed to voting for how their state went, period.
And you know what? Exactly. And the DNC call, which is what they call their rules for the convention,
mm-hmm.
The DNC call only requires that pledged delegates use their good conscience or their best conscience, I forget whether it's good or best, conscience, to decide how to vote. Now, Governor Ed Rendell was on Fox News, and he was saying, because they were talking about the pledged delegate count, and this was in the summer, And Governor Rendell said, well, you know, there's no such thing as a pledged delegate anyway. He said, we got rid of the robot rule a long time ago, and the only requirement we have now is that delegates have to vote their good conscience. I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, no. You might have a rule in the DNC call, but I found 13 states that have laws and those laws trump your club rules. So I was livid. And then I thought, what did he mean by robot rule? He used that term, robot rule. And again, normal people, when you hear a word and you don't know what it means, look it up. It might mean something. I thought it might be what we call a term of art, meaning it means specifically something to the Democrats when they use it that way. I looked up robot rule. You know what it means? It means back in the day, if you were a pledged delegate, you automatically, like a robot, had to cast your vote for that person. But they got rid of that rule. So now it's catchers catch can. Now the Democratic convention, you can do whatever you want. You can vote any way you want. There's no such thing as a pledged delegate to them. But to the 13 states whose voters cared enough about the process, a pledged delegate is a pledged delegate. It means something. In 13 states, God bless them, the voters in those states said, private club, you want to come participate in my political process, get involved in my government, then you need to play by my rules. And my rules say if we're going to spend state monies to carry out a club primary so you can pick the candidates you want to get on our ballots, if you want to participate in that, then when our people vote in our states, even though it's a club primary, their vote means something. So if they elect a delegate pledged to a particular candidate, in our state that means that delegate goes into that convention and votes for that candidate. Now, each of those vote-binding states has kind of different laws. So in some of those vote-binding states, if the candidate releases the vote of the pledge, then the pledged delegate, even on the first vote, can vote for somebody else. In some states, the law says you cannot vote for anybody else on the first ballot. You must vote for the candidate to whom you're pledged. And in one or two of those states, it says you cannot change your vote. So, now
what
see,
two
they
states
just,
are those? What two states were those?
I will tell you. The states, the vote-binding states are the following. And Dr. Kate, I just sent you an email with all the vote-binding states along with the number of delegates per state. I can't seem to get into the chat room, but I'm working on it. If you would post those states along with the number of delegates per state, I would so appreciate that. But the states are Arizona.
They're there. They're on the chat.
Oh, good. Okay, yep. So we've got Arizona, California, Georgia, Indiana, Kentucky, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, New Mexico, Ohio, Oklahoma, Oregon, Tennessee, and Virginia.
Okay, so Colorado wasn't a vote-binding state. It was a delegate being harassed for something else. But that's what got me onto to look up vote-binding states.
Mm-hmm.
Or
it's sort of like an unrelated
but
event.
But I need to add another state. Let me see. Forget that. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Colorado is not one of them.
No, it isn't. Yeah, it isn't. So, but the thing is, I devised this. I came up with this. I thought about this all by myself. And now I thought, oh, my God, I have to do something about it. Because to me, this could have been a deal breaker. So what I did was I was posting primarily on a particular blog. Again, brand new to blogging, totally new, out of my comfort zone. Okay, so I didn't have my own blog. I was posting all over the internet. Every time I discovered something about the process, I would post everywhere I could. I didn't even know enough to copy my comments and paste them in various blogs. I was rewriting original comments every time.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, I blogged a lot on a particular blog, and I don't want to name the blog. There are people I see in the chat from that blog, so we're all set. But I posted a lot on that blog, and I would reveal what I had found, and I would beg the owners of the blog to please post this as an action project for the whole blog. We had over 1,000 readers a day, and we could have done this project. For whatever reason, and I don't want to go into it, but for whatever reason, the owner of the blog did not want to do the project. So I was doing it catch as catch can. I would post a comment and say, for example, is anybody out there from Georgia? And people from Georgia would say, what do you need? And I needed people from the state to sign the letters I had drafted to the attorneys general of those states. You had to be a resident, a legal resident of that state. So I got my Georgians. I started out with the Georgians. And you can imagine how cumbersome it was because you need as many people as you can get, but that means you just keep posting comments on a blog. Is anybody here from Georgia? Is anybody here from Georgia? Mm-hmm. All right. So we got the letters to the Attorney General of Georgia. We got out the letters to all the Hillary Clinton pledge delegates we could find. We had to find spreadsheets of those. I mean, it was a cumbersome project. We said, we have your back. We did that whole project, and you know what happened?
What happened?
Incredible. Less than a week later, the Attorney General of Georgia issued a letter. Oh, I have the chills. Issued a letter saying to the pledge delegates, remember, in our state we have a law. I couldn't believe it. In our state, when you're elected to represent a delegate at the convention, you represent that delegate at the convention. I mean, a candidate at the convention. I couldn't believe it. It worked. And the Georgians, we were hysterical. It worked. A letter to an attorney general that says, well, you know, here's the law, and here are examples where they're enticing people to break the law, and I anticipate that since I pointed this out to you, you'll put a stop to this. And he did.
I'm looking at your list now, and Massachusetts is one of the vote-binding states, and all of those boys.
You got it. You got it.
All of those boys went away. New Hampshire, Virginia,
you got
Oregon,
it.
Oklahoma. Oh, my God.
So
let me add this.
In the state of Virginia, we had at least two pledge delegates. One was Delegate Jennifer McClellan, who is highly thought of, and she's a rising star, and I think the world of her. But it was her and another gentleman, I believe, from Nova, Northern Virginia, who both publicly came out in press conferences stating they were switching their votes from being a Hillary pledge delegate to an Obama pledge delegate, which was a huge disappointment to me, as well as many other Hillary folk. And so therefore, I'm not sure she was aware of Virginia state law about, you know, what you're bringing up here with regards to binding states. I just cannot imagine this rising star would put herself in such a situation. So therefore, I have to assume she was totally unaware because she's a smart cookie and she gets it. So I think there may have been other individuals that were aware that may not have been so honest with those delegates, which is a real shame.
Well, I'll tell you something that happened. Remember I mentioned that Governor Ed Rendell was on the air saying there's no such thing as a pledged delegate. And, of course, I'm going ballistic at this point. About a week, 10 days later, after we'd gotten out the Georgia stuff, Howard Wolfson was on Fox. And he started talking about pledged delegates. And didn't he say, well, you know, some states passed laws that said you have, and I said, oh, my God, the vote binding. He's heard about the work. This was incredible. This is the first, and people were emailing and saying, he said it, they've heard about it. Oh, my God. So I knew I was on to something. And the other thing that happened at the same time, and this is all going on the summer of 2008, so I'm trying to get the word out about vote binding states, and somebody put me on to Ricky Lieberman. I didn't know who she was. It turns out she's from New York, and she's a longtime Democrat activist supporter. And she contacted me, and she said, what's this work you're doing with the vote binding states? And God bless her, she put the information in her newsletter, which goes out to everybody. So now people are starting to find out about the vote binding states, but again, this is all catch as catch can, and trying to alert the pledged delegates from those states, we have your back, it's okay, you know, just vote for Clinton if you're pledged to her. Now, I must say, and this goes to carrying out the work as it was intended to be carried out. The whole purpose of the work to notify the pledged delegates for Hillary Clinton in the vote-binding states was to calm them. They were agitated because they're being harassed. So we wanted to calm them and say, it's okay, because we're letting everybody know what's happening, so it can't happen. It's okay. Well, the owner of the blog where I was posting, somebody wrote a letter and said, okay, I know what we'll do, JBJD. We'll write to those delegates and we'll say, you have a law and you better follow that law. And I'm like, no. Don't do that. You have to hold their hands. And the owner of the blog got on and said, well, JBJD, I think it's okay to tell people it's the law and follow the law. And theoretically, of course, that's true. But the purpose of the action project was to allay the anxiety of the pledged delegates. Because even if you're right and that you can throw in their faces that it's the law, so what are you going to do if they don't vote the way you want them to or vote the way the law says? Do you see? I kept in mind what I wanted to accomplish, and I kept in mind the way to accomplish that, and it wasn't to assert your rightness, but rather to assuage their anxiety. So at any rate, at the same time, remember, Obama has posted in June this document that says, I know there have been questions about my eligibility. Here's proof I'm eligible. Well, I'm sorry. You don't post a document on the Internet and this proof. I know you have concerns, so this will allay your concerns. What are you talking about, allay my concerns? This is a photocopied document on the Internet. So I started thinking, did anybody check to see whether this guy is eligible? I mean,
JBJD, may I ask, just interject before you did that. Did you also notice what he said, what kind of citizen he said he was on the Internet at that time, too?
Yes, that's what I said before, that he said, this proves I'm a native citizen.
Yes, oh. Native citizen. And I think at one point he said native citizen under the 14th Amendment.
Well, and that's actually on my blog. I wondered, where is everybody getting this idea that he's a 14th Amendment native citizen? Where are they getting this idea? They were getting it from the second page of his Fight the Smears website. He didn't put it on the front. He had to look for it a little bit. But, yeah, how obvious. When he wanted to get into a primary, he was required in several states to sign a document saying, I hereby swear that I am 35 years of age, have been in the States for 14 years, and I'm a natural-born citizen, explicitly natural-born citizen. So clearly he knew enough to sign a document to get himself into the primary, I'm a natural-born citizen. Then he goes on Fight the Smears and said, I know you're concerned. Well, here, I am a native citizen. Of course that jumped out at me. What also jumped out at me, and I don't know if people will remember this, but of course that document, within the document, was entitled Certification of Live Birth. And he said underneath that, this is my official birth certificate. Well, of course, as I said, every inconsistency at this point is jumping out at me. And I see native-born, natural-born, certification, and I start posting everywhere. And people hadn't actually noticed that. I went onto the website. When I noticed the difference, the first thing I did was go to the State of Hawaii website to see, is there a difference between a certification and a certificate? Because it seems obvious to me they're two different things. And sure enough, I find the State of Hawaii website, Department of Hawaiian Homeland Status, and it explains in the hierarchy of personal identification, a certification means nothing to us. You need to get your actual birth certificate to apply for homeland status. So I'm posting all over the blogs about this as well. I'm saying, I don't think he's real. This doesn't mean anything. Even if he has an actual document, it doesn't mean anything. Okay, so that's going on at the same time. now we're coming to the convention, and my whole goal in life was not to have to deal with the birth certificate issue or the eligibility or qualification issue or the caucus fraud issue. My whole goal in life was to have a roll call vote on the floor of the convention. Hillary Clinton would win, and I would be done with this crap. I would be out of it and go back to my real life. But first, I had to get a vote on the floor of the convention.
So I want to stop you there, JP.
Let me stop.
If I could.
Yep.
Okay. What I want you to do is talk to us about that floor on the convention, or that vote, the roll call vote on the convention floor. What I want you to do is elaborate, especially with regards to the binding states, because I need to bring you back to that place,
the
binding states, and I need to ask you about some of the binding states, such as California, and the information you recently came across with regards to Lana. That would help your listeners a whole lot to understand that there were games being played long before any of the delegates ever got there. And so would you elaborate on that for me, please?
And that's a separate thing that was going on. Remember starting in February that the certain people in the party were saying that Hillary Clinton had lost the primary. February, and there were several states still to vote. And when you looked at the actual numbers, both in actual popular vote and pledged delegates, by March, they weren't that far apart. So I kept wondering, why are they urging her to get out, to drop out? Why are they characterizing that she's lost when she's in a virtual dead heat? So we get up to the summer, okay, and the rumors started flying that they weren't going to have a roll call, a floor roll call vote, which means that the vote-binding states, the delegates from the vote-binding states, wouldn't get to vote. And their numbers were like in the hundreds. You see, the numbers that we posted on the chat room include both Hillary Clinton pledged delegates, of course, and Obama pledged delegates. It's the number of pledged delegates for the state. So, but they were divided up. Hillary Clinton won California, for example. She won Texas. So the majority of those votes would go to Hillary Clinton. At any rate, they were saying rumors that they weren't going to enter her name to have a floor a roll call vote on the floor. So now we started making phone calls. We made phone calls to the DNC, and they said, "Oh no, we're going to enter her name." Well, we knew the difference between entering your name into a roll and actually putting your name onto the ballot for the floor roll call vote. So within a few days, the news started changing. Then they announced, yes, she's going to get a floor roll call vote. But now what they were going to do was they were going to sequester the delegates in their hotel rooms. And instead of having them vote from the floor, they were going to vote from their hotel rooms. Now, I must say, people from the convention who found out about these pledged delegates, the problem here, were calling me or emailing me, is this a binding vote? I mean, it was hysterical. They were all volunteers. We were all volunteers. We didn't know each other. And it turns out that this is what they did. And I didn't know this at the time. I want to skip over something. This comment by Lana came up very, like, within the last week. But a couple of months ago, I wrote on my blog that in one of the treason articles, I said, I think this all revolves around the vote-binding states, the delegates, the pledged delegates from the vote-binding states. Because the DNC rules, as I said, they say that pledged delegates must use their good conscience or their best conscience to represent their voters. All right? So why didn't they add a line in there that said, unless you're from a vote-binding state, in which case, remember, your state law requires you to represent the candidate you were elected to represent. That's not in the DNC rules. They don't remind delegates of that. So they were, convincing delegates you could vote any way you want. So I wrote 2 months ago, I think if we'd had the votes actually counted of the vote-binding states, that Hillary Clinton could have actually won the delegate count anyway. Well, this woman named Lana, who used to post on Puma Pack, she might still post there, She posted on No Quarter the other day, I almost died. She said, you know, the California delegates hadn't all arrived yet in Colorado for the convention when Nancy Pelosi, the chair of the convention, ordered a delegate vote count for California. So we don't know how many votes were actually cast, how many delegates weren't there, but that to me was the proof. They did not want the delegates from the vote-binding states to vote. Now, you can figure out why. We'll never get an accurate count because they didn't have a full-floor roll call vote. Interesting, huh?
I find that not interesting. I find it disturbing that they would, that the Democratic National Committee in 2008, before the pledged delegates even arrived on the first day of the convention, before the majority of them even arrived, they were asking, at least California, we have not been able to verify at this point whether all binding states were part of the first vote for the DNC on that first day. However, if it was, then obviously we know why. But, and we certainly assume that. However, that being said, they absolutely knew that those binding states, those pledged delegates, had to obey those state laws, just like my colleague, who's a good person here in Virginia, Jennifer McClellan. There's no way she would have ever, not in my wildest dreams, ever have crossed that line and voted illegally, because her loyalty and her commitment to the state of Virginia as well as to the United States of America is strong. So therefore, I know she would never have crossed that legal threshold in order to vote for Barack Obama if it caused her any kind of challenge whatsoever down the road. So therefore, if what I'm understanding you to say is California being the first one, because they were the largest vote getter, or the largest pledged delegate vote getter, they were asked to go at the very beginning when half of their delegates, or three quarters or two thirds, had not even arrived in Denver.
Exactly. What I am saying is, for example, we all watched the Rules and Bylaws Committee, and people were so outraged, and I said, well, they can do that because they're a club. They can do whatever they want. What I'm saying is that the meme that Hillary Clinton had no chance to win this nomination was just that. It was a meme. It was a myth. It was a story that was spelled out by Nancy Pelosi, Howard Dean, Barack Obama, the compliant press. It was a story. It wasn't real. In fact, on my blog, I posted a link to a respected survey that was done immediately after the vote in the general election. And people who had just cast their votes were asked, how would you have voted if Hillary had been there? And she would have beaten John McCain by several percentage points more than Barack Obama beat John McCain. So the meme that she was losing this was just created out of whole cloth. She not only could have beaten him in the actual pledged delegate vote, but she did beat him in the popular vote. So this was all a mirage. Now, okay. So I forgot. So what were you asking me about the?
No, the point that I was trying to make and have you back up was the fact that there were shenanigans being played.
Oh, it was all atypical. Yeah.
They were atypical of what we Democrats, especially me being a lifelong Democrat, are accustomed to. Now, there may have been shenanigans, but never to this extent. And
no.
So therefore, my reality is one, I started watching the DNC conventions when I was 12. I'm 49. And I have never seen anything like this DNC convention. Never. I am accustomed to a roll call vote where each state stands up proudly and announces to the nation, these are our votes, and this is how they're split up. And that did not occur on the floor at the DNC 2008 convention. And I can only assume there's a reason for that. And
well, yes, and that's what people have to remember. You say, I can only assume there's a reason for that. And the reason, which I figured out in hindsight, was that they were going to, one way or the other, make Barack Obama the president. And the only way they could do that was Hillary Clinton kept not dropping out. She wouldn't drop out. With all the fraud and the illegal campaign donations and she just kept going. So now the only way they can steal the nomination is literally avoid a vote. And just steal it. Just steal it.
That's what they did as a private club.
That's exactly.
I talked to a couple of delegates here in Virginia when they came back from the DNC convention. And I said, how was it? How'd you guys enjoy it? Blah, 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 blah. And what I learned is they were summoned to their hotel rooms.
Yep.
And they had to place their votes via a phone call. And when I learned that, I thought, well, geez Louise, how do we know the integrity of that vote? How do I know as a Democrat that that vote wasn't slanted or that vote? I've just got to say this. The thing that was most disturbing to me as a Democrat is the fact that the Coliseum, the PepsiCo Convention Center, started to be built out 2 weeks prior to the DNC convention, which was just so disgusting and appalling to so many of us Hillary folk. And I couldn't help but believe here they are just absolutely snubbing it and rubbing it in our noses, when indeed I can't help but believe, after everything I've learned that occurred at the DNC convention, this has never occurred. And I want our listeners to understand, it never occurred in our democratic history where a vote was hidden, and it wasn't a public roll call vote. And so, therefore, they had decided long before, the powers that be, the DNC election committee decided 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, 6 months, who knows, before that convention was held, that Obama was going to be the victor, no matter what Hillary Clinton did.
And you know what would have stopped them? It was those vote-binding states that I stumbled onto, that I made the case for, that I begged people to do prowls on. You know, Ricky Lieberman, God bless her, she contacted Allegra's Corner and said, can you post this stuff? And every time I needed people from a state, I'd go to there. I said, I need people from the state. But it was too late to do the whole, and I want to cry every time I speak about this, because now Lara posts this comment about the California delegates, and I think, oh, my God, I was right. I could have pulled this out.
Now, I just interject a larger observation here as we move on, and to just remind you, we've got about a half hour left on this first segment. You all have time, because next week we're going to do another segment if we don't finish tonight, so don't worry.
Oh, we're not going to finish tonight, Dr. Cade.
You know,
there's no way we can finish this wonderful conversation, but I thank you.
It's astounding to me that, you know, the lack of awareness of the rules, the manipulation of this, and the larger perspective on all of this is that it prevented all of us from really looking at who the heck Obama was. His very revealing statement, you know, finally pressured that he's a native citizen under the 14th Amendment, and various other things that were coming up. But all of this,
Kate, I have to tell you something. Of course, when he first announced he was running, I looked him up, and I didn't know anything about him. And what was most important to me is, assuming he gets into the White House, the people who will be in charge of his foreign policy are the people who are advising him now, and foreign policy to me was the biggest thing. So I investigated the people on his foreign policy advisory, and I don't want to go into Samantha Power et al., but that was enough for me. So I knew he couldn't get into the White House. Well, I had to do everything I could to keep him out. But there were so many issues that occurred simultaneously. So I teach, and I'm off for the summer. I'm telling you, I would go to sleep with my computer at my head and wake up with my computer at my head. I was on that computer all the time. God bless my child. It was like he was an orphan. But I was on it all the time. I couldn't get enough of the news. Now, remember, it's not just getting a floor roll call vote, because if we can't get a vote there, nothing matters anyway. I was always in crisis mode for the next step. Don't get Hillary or get Hillary from dropping out. Then make sure the delegates stay bound. And, you know, it was always the next step. But let me just say that just before the convention, I said, God forbid the worst thing happens and Obama gets the nomination. How are we going to prevent him from getting into the White House? And this is how I'll end the past segment, okay? People were frenetic at this point. It had been 2 months, June, July, August. It had been 2 months since Obama had posted that coal. I had already gotten out the news of coal that is not a certificate. The whole thing. So people now were frenetic.
JB, can I interrupt you? And I don't mean to be rude. Could you tell people what a COLB is? Because you're assuming everybody knows what you're talking about.
I'm so sorry. Certification of live birth. And remember, the document Obama posted was a certification of live birth, and he wrote underneath, this is my official birth certificate. So, you know, I had a ding, 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 ding. Anyway,
But let me just stop you. A COLB, a certification of live birth, is not a birth certificate. Am I correct?
It's not. And in the state of Hawaii, at that time, their website explicitly distinguished the two, so that they said, don't bother coming to us if you want to certify, for example, Hawaiian homeland status, don't come to us with a COLB. It's nothing. We need the original birth certificate. So at that time, they distinguished between the two documents, because when I noticed that the wording had been changed from the document itself to what Obama was claiming it was, and I don't need him to interpret for me. I can see the document for myself. So now, remember, I didn't think the document was real or not real. It didn't matter to me. What I always do is, if I see something on the web, if I assume it's real, does it establish what the person who posted it wants to establish? So he's saying, this establishes I'm a native citizen. And I said, well, assuming it's a real document, does it establish that? No, it doesn't. So that's the end of my analysis. And then I post it everywhere and say, COLB is not a birth certificate, and he said it was, and whatever. But here's the thing. What if, so people are now all over the internet, and I'm seeing their frustration, and people are calling the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, to complain. I don't think he's a natural born citizen, but the FEC deals with campaign finance, so I would copy the link to FEC, which is our government. Our money is supporting this office. We should know what they do. So I would post that around. People were going to the Secretaries of State. He's not eligible. But the Secretaries of State, by law, don't have to vet the candidate. There's no provision of any state or federal law. No provision.
Well, and if I can interject, because I read your post as a citizen of Virginia, and I read that post and I read another post over at Texas Darlin, and the two posts were basically saying is contact your state board of elections secretary and tell them or share with them that they need to vet this nominee. And I did that. I contacted the Virginia secretary of the state board of elections, and I stated to this individual and shared the various information that was posted on that particular blog, and said, you know, there's some serious questions here. What are we going to do about that? And so the secretary, being responsible, contacted her people at the Federal Election Commission in D.C., her point of contact, and raised this issue. And that person at the FEC confirmed, or should I say affirmed, to the Secretary of the State Board of Elections that indeed he'd been vetted and that he was eligible. However,
okay, wait, I need you to stop because that's, you might have been told that, but it's incorrect information. The FEC has nothing to do with vetting the candidate. So if somebody told you that the FEC vetted the candidate, that person is lying to you or misstating what happened or you misheard. The FEC has absolutely no authority or no mechanism, no authority and therefore no mechanism for vetting a candidate that is outside of the scope of their jurisdiction. The other thing I want to say explicitly is saying to it, and I know it sounds like I'm parsing here, is saying to a Secretary of State, it looks like there could be a problem here, is not the same thing as filing a challenge. And so what I was asking people to do, and it was one of my 3 a.m. epiphanies, we don't know what this
means. Eureka moment.
I'm sorry?
Another eureka moment. My apologies.
Another,
go ahead.
I mean, this was really a eureka moment, because what if the guy's not qualified? What are we going to do? And I have already established there's no provision in any law that says anybody has to check. And there's no more barrier here. What are we going to do? So then I thought, well, some states, like Georgia again, have laws that say only eligible candidates can get on the ballot. Now, remember, there's no law that says anybody has to check. But the state is saying, you wanna play on our field, you have to pay the price. So you can have your name on our ballots only if you're an eligible candidate. So I said, well, in those states that have those laws, you can file a ballot challenge. So like Georgia has a mechanism for filing a ballot challenge. It's not just saying to the Secretary of State, I'm concerned about this candidate's eligibility, but you literally have to file it for, you put it in writing and you say, I am challenging the eligibility of this candidate to get on the ballot. The problem is, again, you need a forum. You need to be able to announce to people across the country, don't go to the FEC, don't go to the state, don't have jurisdiction, challenge the inclusion of the name on the ballot, but you need to look up your state law now, because once the convention happens and once the nomination is made, the law says these parties have to submit the name of the nominee to the state elections people within very short time frames from the time of the convention. So sometimes it's 24 hours, sometimes it's a few days. So you need to know the laws in advance and then put in the challenges. So at 3 a.m. I start posting everywhere. I know what to do. Challenge his name on the ballot. Keep him off, because if he's not on the ballot, he's not going to be the president.
May I interject here? Because, D2, I was the one who wrote those posts about writing to the Secretary of State.
Yes, you were. Thank you.
And I am just mad that I wrote a letter. I suggested writing a letter. And honestly, if I had known, I mean, it's the difference of a word. You challenge versus writing a letter and saying, here's, there's a problem. I suggested a letter saying, here's, there's a problem, but my goodness. But it's good to know that we can challenge them, because it was the same thing. I looked up the laws in my state, too, and it was immediately after the convention, September 8th or something like that, that had to happen. So there still was a chance. But I just sent a letter. I didn't send
Well, let me ask you this. I really need you to back up, because one of the things that you're both raising is extremely important, and I don't think we've really made it abundantly clear, and that is, who is responsible for vetting a presidential nominee, and are there any federal actors involved in such a process? And secondly, why are those individuals the only ones that vet the nominee?
Well, I'm going to let JBJD go with that.
Well, the Constitution tells us how to do this. And the Constitution says that the second Tuesday, or the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, the governor will appoint electors. Now, we hold what we call a general election to elect electors. But the Constitution doesn't say anything about general election or political parties. It only says to elect a president, you have to, the governor appoints the electors on that Tuesday. Then it says that in December, whatever the date is, the electors vote for the president. It doesn't say they have to vet the president for constitutional eligibility. It doesn't say they have to be promised that they will vote for the nominee of the party to which they belong. None of that is in the Constitution. It's pretty simple. So then the Constitution says that the Congress will ratify the Electoral College vote. Doesn't say that Congress has to vet the candidate or they can only ratify the EC vote if the Electoral College has vetted the candidate. It's silent on that. It just says you ratify the vote. So in other words, theoretically, if the vote occurred in a procedurally correct manner, the Congress ratifies the vote. You see, there's no mechanism required by law, constitution or statute or otherwise, to vet the candidate. But here's the problem I had, and I don't mind saying this. Anybody who was paying attention knew there were issues as to the man's eligibility. And people were spending countless hours from June on researching and blogging, and I kept saying, why are you doing this? You are hiring him. If he doesn't tell you who he is, don't hire him. To me, it was always backwards. Even up till recently, it's backwards. People are going off on all kinds of tangents trying to figure out these convoluted ways to establish whether the man is constitutionally eligible for the job. I've always maintained, who knows? You know, I swear a lot, and you don't know how challenging this is right now to make sure that I edit out all of my swears before you stop me. But anyway, it was always backwards to me. I said, no, make him prove it. And that's, I'm skipping over a lot, but that's where I came to the major, major epiphany, which was around December, January of 2009.
Okay, so before you go there,
I have to stop now, but I'm saying that was when it hit me. Well, he knows if he's eligible, but we don't. But
okay,
if we how does anyone else know?
That's right. So let me sum up so you can go into that, and I'll sum up very quickly.
Okay.
That is, the caucuses and the way they were managed, anybody that wants to learn the various caucus issues, they can go on the web. There are plenty of sites. There's one in particular that has documented what occurred in Texas with regards to fraudulent activity.
I have to stop you. There's something very important about Texas that's a little bit different from what I've said for the other states. I stressed that what happens with the private club called the DNC doesn't implicate any governmental rights. Well, except in Texas, something happened. The Democratic Party allocated delegates according to the population in Texas. Well, some Latino districts in Texas filed a federal lawsuit against the DNC for over-allocating delegates to black districts and under-allocating delegates to Latino districts. And the federal court agreed that this is a valid lawsuit and gave them the approval to go ahead with the lawsuit. So I didn't mean to interrupt, but in Texas, the way the party allocated the delegates, and we know there was a problem in Texas, it did implicate some constitutional rights. So,
okay, so we know that there was caucus fraud because we also know that Hillary's campaign, following several of the variations on what occurred in those caucus states, they filed complaints as well. And
yeah,
there are videos out there where real live people, delegates, people just like you and me, folk, who found that the caucus and the way they were managed and the way the outcomes and the votes were in question. So we know that caucus was there's question marks about the caucus states, and there's certainly some indication of fraudulent activity. Then we know that Hillary won the majority of the primary states. Then we know that the DNC denied initially the fact that there were 13 states that had binding state laws for pledged delegates, meaning that those delegates, when they went to the convention, had to at least, at a minimum, depending on the state, at a minimum, had to vote the first round for the for the candidate or the nominee that brought them to the convention. So therefore, we know that there are 13 states that are vote-binding states. We know that the DNC chose to eliminate their robot rule, which was the rule stating that there were no pledged delegates, which is what I believe Governor Rendell was speaking to. However, Howard Wolfson, a couple of weeks later, said, no, there are 13 vote-binding states, and those delegates must vote at a minimum.
He didn't number the states, but he clearly mentioned there are states that require, he didn't say vote binding, but he clearly was correcting the misimpression and saying
there are pledged delegates.
So he's
clearly correcting that.
Yep.
And so we know that there are 13 vote binding states. Now we're at the convention, and we learn that California, being the largesse of the pledged delegates going for Hillary, we learn that the many delegates that were in the air on trains, in cars, had not even gone or been able to arrive at the convention before they were told to vote. They had no forewarning. They were not told at any time that you need to be here by 9 a.m. on whatever day, and you need to cast your vote by then, otherwise your vote's not going to count. They gave no notice whatsoever California or any other vote-binding state.
But let me stop you for a second. As you said, as we all know, not a lot of people knew that some of these states, some of the delegates from some of these states, are required by the laws of their states to vote for the candidate on the first round. Most people didn't know that. So can you imagine this? The mem has been that Hillary Clinton cannot win this nomination. Now, what happens if you have a state like California with pledged delegates who must vote for her in the first round? Virginia, Massachusetts, what happens if those delegates are on the floor of the convention and carry out their state laws, right? And vote for Hillary Clinton because they're required to by law. People seeing that are going to think, wow, she has a ton of support out there. People who didn't switch to Obama, even though they could have. Do you see? That was the problem.
So at that point, the DNC, we can assume or we can surmise that the DNC election committee chose to have those pledged delegates from those binding states to vote even before the convention started. Individuals were in the air, they're on the train, they're driving their cars, whatever, to get to the convention, because all of us, normal Democrats, are assuming there's going to be a roll call vote, because that's what we're accustomed to. We know you do a public roll call vote, and the state stands up proudly and says, we from Virginia, the greatest state in the union, we declare blah, blah, blah delegates for this candidate and blah, blah, blah delegates for that candidate. That's what we're accustomed to, but that did not occur. It did not occur.
Why?
And that's what pisses me off more than
anything else. Why didn't it occur?
So you ask yourself, why didn't it occur? Exactly.
Yep.
And so then we learn that it did not occur. We learn later that delegates were told to go to their hotel rooms to cast their votes from their hotel rooms, and somebody is tallying these votes, but nobody has ever come out and told us what those votes were. Instead, what we've learned is that PepsiCo Center, I keep going back to that, because 2 weeks before the convention,
mm-hmm.
and we know these 10 vote-binding states, or 13 vote-binding states, could tilt the nomination to Hillary.
Well, we don't know.
I know. I believe it did. My hunch is I believe it did.
I believe. Oh, yeah. No, don't get me wrong. I believe this was the key to everything.
I did, too.
Yeah.
So what do? They cannot possibly have an empty PepsiCo field where, you know, the Roman temple was built. And so, therefore, they had to go, or not had to, they had every intention of making sure Obama was the nominee.
Let me tell you something. I hear you. And you know what else I think? And people who've read my blog, I don't like to speculate. I just don't like to speculate. But I have to tell you something. I think because they found out that people are getting wind of the fact there are vote-binding states, I think they scrambled as fast as they could to figure out how to keep these states from voting in front of everybody.
So up until that point, other than the caucus fraud, up until that point, or the supposed caucus fraud, I should say, up until that point, the DNC had broken no state laws. Am I correct?
That's right.
So when the convention was over and Nancy Pelosi and Alice Gehrman signed the certifications of nomination.
Yes.
And the notary signed those certifications of nomination that then went out to the 50 states. Now, there are some states, as you and I both know, where the Democratic Party chairman was required by their state law to sign those certifications of nomination.
Hold on. I did not know the exact mechanism for the official nominee's name to get to the states. I knew that the state party chairs generally would have to notify the secretaries of state so the secretaries of state could put the name on the ballot. So that's why I was saying to people, before the convention, find out how to challenge the ballot, because the name's going to get on the ballot somehow. But the other thing that was going on in my mind was, how can they certify that he's eligible if all they have is that June cold that he posted?
The certification of life or...
You got it. That doesn't establish that he's constitutionally qualified for the job. And people said, oh, there must be this. I said, no, the best evidence they have is that, because he said, I know you question my eligibility, so here's the proof. Well, why is he going to put out something less than the best he has to allay these concerns? I knew that was the best he had. I knew that's what Nancy, I didn't know, but I assumed that's the best she could have used. That and the word of Annenberg political fact check that, oh, he's legitimate, he was born in the USA, which still doesn't mean he's natural born, it means he could be native. But I said, that's the best she could have to prove that he's eligible to get on the ballot.
Thank you. Tell us a little bit about Annenberg and Barack Obama's relationship. We've got...
It looks like we've got
7 minutes, and we're going to tie up here because I don't want to go into your memorandum of complaints until next week.
Let's go ahead and talk about Annenberg. Kate wants to spend
a couple of minutes.
Okay. Let me very quickly say, again, I was looking at everything through skeptical eyes. So on Barack Obama's own website, and this is what I advised people to do, use his own words to hang him. You don't know what else is real, but you know he clearly said this on his website. So on his website he said, and if you don't believe what I'm posting here, here's a link directly to Annenberg Political Fact Check, and they are an independent concern. And I said, oh, my God, I had been doing research for months on this guy, and I knew that he had been the chair of the Chicago Annenberg Challenge from 1995 to 1999, and to call the people who employed him an independent concern jumped out at me as hypocritical, nonsensical. So I knew he was lying. So that was right. And then I went to Annenberg and I looked them up, and they are college kids. They belong to a college. They work out of a college that Annenberg gave money to. So that's how they get their name.
Right. So Annenberg Fact Check is a subsidiary of the Annenberg Foundation.
Foundation. Yep.
And
they are
Annenberg
only
Challenge. Let me stop you. The Annenberg Challenge.
Yep.
Was Barack Obama's employer for 5 years with Bill Ayers in Chicago. Is that correct?
Well, Bill Ayers was the head of the small schools project, and Annenberg funneled millions of dollars to Bill Ayers' small schools project through the Annenberg Challenge. But the thing that struck me, people, you have to look at these things. The thing that struck me is, here's a guy with no background, with very little credentials, very little employment credentials. Here's his resume. What is missing from that resume? He was a chair of a major foundation educational challenge in Chicago for 4 or 5 years. For goodness sake, wouldn't you put that on your resume when you have so little else there? Why was that omitted from his resume? That raised red flags to me. See? And then he calls it independent.
So we know that Annenberg Fact Check is his former employer.
You got
it. We know that Annenberg Fact Check took the certification of live birth and stated that shared with the public that, see, he's native born. But then
you know what else we know?
So this is where I want to leave it, and we've got to wrap up.
Don't do the newspaper.
Can you tell us what they did?
Don't do the newspaper thing. The other thing is that Barack Obama, you can see in the footer of his Fight the Smears website, that he paid for that website. So the only information that says I'm for real is his website that he paid for with a picture he posted verified by his employer. That's it.
That's astounding. That's astounding to me. Please go ahead, Helen, Detoy.
Well, no, I want to keep our listeners engage so they come back next week, and that is I want to leave our conversation. I'm not going to do a wrap-up after this, and Dr. Kate, I wouldn't advise it either for you other than to say goodnight.
Oh, no, definitely not.
I would just like JBJD to tell us, or at least give us a cliffhanger, and that cliffhanger is that advertisement.
Unbelievable.
And, yeah,
so
and then I think we can wrap up. And I really hope all of you folk that have taken your valuable time, and I'm so grateful for it, come back and listen to us next week, because next week is when we go into the memorandum of complaint. We go into
the Phantom newspaper.
So much more.
Yeah.
So
please, this was so quick, but if you read the blog, and I'm just not that organized on the blog, but the content is there. It's not that easily accessible unless you just read it, but there's some great stuff on the blog that pulls all this together, so it fills in the details.
There we go. We're going to have
okay.
to hang up. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Join us next week at the same time for part two. Thank you, JBJD. Thank you,
Dr. Kate.
Well.
Thank you very much.
Wonderful. Thank you.
All right.
Thank
you. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Good night.
for amber waves of green, for purple mountains' majesty, above the fruited plain, America, America, God shed His grace on me and crowned thy good with brotherhood, from sea to shining sea.
I want to say,